Clay Kessler, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2, Howard Braun and Selma Weiss are interviewing. You mentioned that today you would like to speak about the history of the Montefiore Hospital. So let's start with the history.
All right, let me just, to have some continuity, let me point out that we were talking the last time we met about my experiences on coming back to Pittsburgh after training for 7 years or so in New York and finding some of the gaps in medical care here that I found my training was specifically directed to fill. But we'll get back to that another time. But I thought that while we're on the subject of my coming back to Montefiore Hospital, in a sense, that's why, one of the major reasons why my family came back to Montefiore Hospital, to Pittsburgh, was because of my a particular interest in returning to Montefiore Hospital as a base of operations for my future practice.
Hello.
Not in any message. We forgot to connect the machine. Well, anyway. And this brings us to the subject of Montefiore Hospital, and I would like to, though we've not made a formal presentation before, since this affects not me personally, but a major institution in the city of Pittsburgh, major Jewish institution, I've even given it a title. And the title of this tape will be The Rise and Fall of Montefiore Hospital. My time at Montefiore Hospital dates to my internship in 1948. But my knowledge of Montefiore Hospital, because of that association, goes back some years before that. And I can briefly summarize what that entails. I was not around, and do I know about how it was originally formed? I know a little bit about the Ladies Aid Society, which became the Ladies Hospital Aid Society, deciding that they were going to do something like this in the early part of the century. All those details I really can't talk about, and I'm not going to. But I will say that during the Depression years, Montefiore Hospital was already an established institution. At that time, Montefiore Hospital built on independent ground. It had been offered the ground by what was the University of Pittsburgh land, which was the place, which was a place offered to them to build a hospital free of charge. But I understand that it was turned down because it would have been a loss of authority over the hospital. It would have been giving the authority to the university, and the Jewish community at that time, the Ladies Hospital Aid Society and whoever else was involved, had refused on that basis. They wanted to maintain control. And perhaps as I go on, we can talk about what that meant to the Jewish community at that time. It turned out that Presbyterian Hospital became the university hospital, accepted the university's, or that group accepted the university's offer and built what is known as Presbyterian Hospital, but now Presbyterian University Hospital. During the Depression years, I started to mention, the sophistication in medicine had not yet developed, and it was a very primary, basic function of doing some rather basic laboratory testing. Patients were hospitalized for hardly what we consider today to be important illnesses. There weren't too many illnesses that were really treatable or diagnosable in the real sense. A lot of what was done was basic surgeries such as gallbladders, hysterectomies, delivering of babies, that sort of thing. Chest surgery was not even dreamed of, heart surgery certainly not, neurosurgery only minimally. And during the Depression years, it's my information that Dr. Thomas Shue really maintained what was then Montefiore Hospital, with operations mostly on women, having to do with women's organs, women's illnesses. And I'm told that during the Depression years, when other hospitals were begging for patients, the Montefiore Hospital did pretty well because Dr. Shue alone would carry a service of 50 patients, and that's a lot of surgical patients.
Is it Shubi?
S-C-H-U-B-B.
All Jewish women
love
Dr.
Shue. Yeah, oh yes, they all love Dr. Shue. He really became a legend in Jewish medicine, which I may mention as we go along. I remember there was a famous internist in Pittsburgh by the name of Lawrence Wexler. His son practiced after him. His son is exactly my age, Richard Wexler. He has a son now practicing in neurology by the name of Larry Wexler. At any rate, I remember that Dr. Wexler, Dr. Kalaman were well known. They made house calls for 50 cents during the Depression years. These were specialists. These were not general practitioners. These were men who went on to specialty training. Of course, specialty training in those days was not nearly as comprehensive or as time-consuming as it eventually became. But nonetheless, they were considered to be specialists. And that they told me stories. I knew them, that group of doctors, quite well, because when I got into medicine, they were really our senior physicians. During the war, there were doctors that were actually deferred. I couldn't think of the word, deferred from draft status, because they were essential to maintaining the functioning of local hospitals. And among those doctors were some of the primary surgeons at Montefiore Hospital and some of their primary physicians who were able to stay and keep the hospital going. And the hospitals all were pretty busy during those years. I don't think any hospital had any major problem filling their beds. It was toward the end of the 40s, when I graduated medical school, that I became directly involved with Montefiore Hospital. And I'll just make some comments about my involvement and what was going on as the bigger picture in what might be termed Jewish medicine. The year was about 1948, and I remember 47. And I remember very well that efforts to obtain interns was a major thrust of the Jewish community, and particularly the board of directors of the Montefiore Hospital, as well as the other senior physicians. They actually went out soliciting young Jewish medical students. Now, the problem, of course, was that I think I did mention earlier that there was a quota system, so that there was only X number of, in the case of Pitt Medical School, there were 8 Jewish medical students 1 year and 9 Jewish medical students the other year. So in 2 years, there were a potential for 17 Jewish doctors in Pittsburgh, unless they went to schools outside of Pittsburgh. So that in order to obtain a full intern class, they made an all-out effort. And the all-out effort consisted of, believe it or not, a threat that if you didn't intern at Montefiore Hospital, you couldn't practice there. And if you couldn't practice there, you had difficulty if you intended to affiliate with a hospital, because you were not welcome in other hospitals. There were some glaring exceptions. Hospitals, like many institutions, had their token Jewish representative. But it was just, you just couldn't assume that because you had the necessary qualifications and the necessary achievements, that you were going to find a hospital in which you could practice if you were Jewish. So that it was very important to secure one's position and enter a monastery. So that from a certain point of view, the intensity of the pressure resulted in going to Montefiore to intern. It also ensured practice, but it also ensured something that the other hospitals did not have insured for them, and that was a full intern class. Internships, though not too significant in today's medicine in the same sense as it was then, was a very important function in making a hospital a better place in which to be treated as a patient. Now, that is in itself a long story. But residency programs, in other words, training in specialties, was not yet as important as it later became. So that the intern was really the focus of how a hospital obtained what is called a house staff to take care of patients on a 24-hour basis. Montefiore, in my judgment, was a better hospital because not only did it have a full class of interns, but I needn't tell you that they were the top people in their class. So that there were some notable exceptions. There were young men who were Jewish who did not either want to identify as Jews or did not want to be put under the gun, under that pressure, and went to other hospitals. Interestingly, these other hospitals would take you as an intern, it didn't mean they would take you to practice. So that they were in jeopardy as far as that was concerned. So that I remember that, I distinctly remember that Seal Frank called my mother on the telephone. And I remember I was studying, I think I was a junior in medical school, and you had to make your commitments in advance. And I remember her explaining to my mother, they were friends, and explaining to my mother the importance of my committing to Montefiore Hospital. And Richard Wexler, who was a class ahead of me, he became, though he was my age, whose father had been leading physician at Montefiore Hospital, also called me and made it clear that my place was at Montefiore Hospital. It was a decision at that time that I made to intern at Montefiore that I never really regretted, but it somewhat, in retrospect, one wonders if we were not misled and whether or not what happened subsequently was in fact a dirty trick on the Jewish community of doctors. And I bring this up now and will explain it later because there's a great deal of hostility that exists today among Jewish doctors toward the Jewish community, organizational, structurally, that is based on this kind of pressure and this kind of identification. You were committed, you were forced in a way, you were promised in a way, and then boom. Here we are years later, and there is no Jewish hospital in Pittsburgh. So that's why I think this is a very important history to understand all the dynamics of it. I then accepted the internship, began this in the midst of a time that I was very involved in organizing the young Jewish community of Pittsburgh as a major contributor to the needs of the Jewish people. So that my work as an intern was called to the attention of the then head of the hospital, whose name was Sidney Bergman. Mr. Sidney Bergman, I personally had great admiration for. I liked him enormously. He was, I must say, like all jobs of that type in the Jewish community, a matter of controversy. But nonetheless, he and I saw eye to eye. We got along very well. And on several occasions, he made a point, and as an intern, I must tell you, who's ever listening to this, that for an intern to be called down to the office of the director of the hospital on numerous occasions was not something that you took lightly. You were either called because you were being censured, or in my case, because I was being pressured to work toward a position of importance in the Jewish community as a physician. And Sidney Bergman made it clear that it was very important for doctors to participate in the Jewish community in a social sense, philanthropic sense, and that not many doctors were doing that, and they had me pegged to be that person. For that reason, he wanted me to specialize, become a specialist. It was my hope and plan all of my young life to be a general practitioner. And he tried to impress me with the importance of becoming a specialist so that I would better fit the role that he and others had for me in the Jewish community. At the same time, I happened to be at that time a member of the board of directors of the Federation of Jewish Philanthropies, because the mother tapes is clear that I was very active in organizing the young Jewish community, and for that was so-called rewarded, I guess is the word, with a position on the board of directors. So that I really had two different hats, and as such was then appointed to the committee for the overseeing of medical support of the Jewish Home for the Aging. That was a very important committee because it served to organize, it was one of the early moves of the Jewish community to provide medical care for the aging. Now, these are the days long before what we accept today as routine, such as what is the name of it? The over 65 program in medical care.
Medicare.
There was no Medicare. Old people simply either could get free medical care from their own doctor or didn't get it at all, because most people could not pay for medical care once they were no longer working unless they happened to be well off. So that it was very important in the Jewish community that we provided this through the Jewish Home for the Aged, and I was the member of the committee who helped organize it. Then, when I finished my internship, and because I was interested in general medicine, I accepted the responsibility for a salary of taking on the job of actually delivering that medical care at the Jewish Home for the Aged. So I had two offices and an office at the Jewish Home for the Aged. One office was on Darlington Road in Squirrel Hill. One office, and I think I've mentioned this, was in the Hill District, and I had a third office at the Jewish Home for the Aged. So I would go to the Jewish Home for the Aged in the morning from 8 to 12, and then to the office in the afternoon in the Hill District, and then in the evening to Darlington Road. Try to develop my skills and so forth. But at any rate, I had a lot of involvement, therefore, with some of the politics as well as the practice of medicine in the days after the war. Another trend developed after World War II, and that was the trend towards specialties. I was a general practitioner. I was still being pressured by Sidney Bergman, the director of Montefiore Hospital, to move on to a specialty, but still managed to reject it and to get my experience in general practice. I remember, as a matter of fact, for my work in the Jewish community, I was influential in getting somebody to donate the first paging system at Montefiore Hospital. That is always very significant to me because now we take paging systems for granted. At that time, it was not taken for granted. We used bells, and everybody had a code, a bell code. And as hospitals grew and doctors grew, it became very confusing. You had to hear every sound of the bell. If somebody was talking and you missed one of the sounds of the bells, you would not know whose page it was. So we finally got somebody. It was during my internship. And that happened to be Seal Frank. Seal Frank came from the well-known Frank and Kaplan family of Pittsburgh and donated it. But I would also like to comment that I remember very well how much it cost. And I mention it only because in contrast with what prices are these days, it cost $1,700 for the entire paging system of Montefiore Hospital, which was then in use as long as I can remember after that. I remained in general practice until the Korean War broke out and I was drafted to go. I was warned by the draft board. The head of the draft board happened to be a patient of mine, and he warned me that my name was coming up so that I better do something. Strangely, I had been in the service as a pharmacist made third class during World War II, but a special law was passed by the Congress of the United States, which stated that if you had not served the United States government as a physician, that it was necessary to do so on pain of being drafted. So rather than be drafted, I then enlisted in the Air Force and served 2 years during the Korean conflict. I was in New York at the time at an air base. Which turned out to be a wonderful experience, and nothing very important about that, except that when I came back to Pittsburgh, when I came back to Pittsburgh, I had experienced something in the military that was happening all over the world of medicine, and that was the word specialization. I had some experience as a general practitioner in Pittsburgh for the 2 years, 2.5 years prior to my being pushed into the military again for the second time, that people, particularly our people, were not very happy with general practitioners. There was an increasing demand for specialists. It was somewhat distressing to me to find out that people who really should have gone to their general physician were going, if they had a bellyache, they would go to the general surgeon. If they had a stuffed nose, they would go to an ENT specialist, and it was already starting. And then when I got into the military, I learned that in the military, the general practitioner was nothing and nobody. He was given the lowest job on the totem pole, which was running the outpatient clinic. Even a young physician who had 6 months of residency training, for example, I remember a specific case, in especially like internal medicine, was given a ward of his own. In other words, he was in charge of inpatient care, which was an advanced form of medical care compared to taking care of the sick bay, so to speak, the dispensary. So that by the time I came back, I was already pretty much brainwashed into the subject of becoming a specialist. The opportunity arose particularly that the then head of the Department of Neurosurgery, there was only one Jewish neurosurgeon, that was David Kostkoff, Dr. David Kostkoff. He was a very unusual, outstanding man, came from Connecticut, from New Haven, Connecticut, and had wonderful training and had a PhD as well as an MD, and had done some very basic and original research work with one of the leaders of the field of neurophysiology by the name of Fulton at Yale, so that he was eminently qualified to be my first preceptor and would happen to have an unusually outstanding personality, and I was very attracted to him. He was also extremely devoted to the idea of mind as part of the total patient care, the mind of the patient, not only the body of the patient, which I happen to have some immediate identification with. And therefore, it was a rather nice harmony of events that I decided, therefore, to become a neurosurgeon training, beginning my training under his auspices. The situation at Montefiore at that time, and I'm talking now about 1953, was that there had been during the 40s, before, during the war, after the war, and at this time in the early 50s, a continuous internecine struggle for power among physicians. And that power was shared between three major surgeons. They were Thomas Shube, who I've already mentioned, Sidney Rosenberg, and Herbert Frankenstein. And each built their own little empires. And each struggled to maintain some control of what went on within the confines of the hospital. It was not particularly constructive to the hospital, but it wasn't destructive either, because they, in their way, made a serious contribution to education of Jewish doctors. They did train a lot of people in general surgery, but there was very little else in the way of specialization in the average hospital that could go toward training great numbers of physicians. We did have another man by the name of Leo Creek, who was well known in the field of allergy, who was able to train allergy people. We did have other specialties, but not official training specialties. So that we didn't have a training specialty question. We didn't have a training specialty in neurosurgery at that time. That what we call a super specialty or a subspecialty, and these were not yet, these had not yet arrived at the private hospitals such as Montefiore. The struggle between these three men was interesting because in some ways, I said it wasn't particularly destructive, but it did prevent advancement and development, because the issue always came in a struggle on the board level with who was in charge here. And there was really nobody in charge, because what they did was divide the senior position of chief of service between these three men, and they alternated on a 3-month basis. So there was never any one particular direction. As such, the head of the hospital, the non-medical person, was Sidney Bergman. I happen to like Sidney, but there was a lot of resentment among the staff that Sidney Bergman should not really be in charge because he was not a doctor. This issue was a universal issue. It still is to some degree. But on the other hand, in those days, it sort of held back advancement. Because of this, the board of directors decided to direct that there should be a permanent full-time chief of staff. And that person finally agreed upon, after much politics, was David Koskoff. And he was the logical man for a number of reasons. First of all, David was an eminently likable and respectable fellow, and not overtly competitive, and certainly not financially competitive with those other doctors, because David never cared about money, never thought in terms of making a lot of money out of medicine. And he also didn't do the same kind of specialty that the other three leading surgeons did. He was a neurosurgeon and did only brain and spine surgery, so that in that sense he was somewhat independent from them. In the other sense, he had a PhD in research physiology, and this put him in another special category. So that the board of directors at that time was made up of such people as Stanley Kahn, I.D. Wolf, Elmer Hamburg, Harry Epstein. These were the leaders, major leaders of the Jewish community, particularly involved with the hospital, also Oliver Kaufman, L.B. Foster, but particularly I.D. Wolf, who was then the president of the hospital at that time, was very close to Koskoff, and it was he who pushed for Koskoff to be the chief of staff. And the other thing was, Koskoff was willing to be the chief of staff based on what is known as a full-time position. In other words, he would be paid by the hospital. There was not anybody else who was on the scene and eligible for such a position who would have accepted a salary from the hospital. This is a continuing, ongoing discussion in medicine even today. But most jobs of this administrative type require that the physician accept a salary and not be competitively in practice with those people that he's going to really be in charge of. So I came into this scenario. Since I had aligned myself